the wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
September 11, 2001. The United States is hit by four coordinated terrorist attacks, the first major assault on the U.S. soil since World War II. Nearly 3,000 people are killed and some 20,000 others injured. The U.S. responds with an all-out war on Afghanistan, where the terror group Al-Qaeda that planned and carried out the attack was said to be based. Fast forward 20 years. U.S. President Joe Biden signed an executive order in September giving the Justice Department a six-month notice to release the documents on the FBI's investigations into the incident. Yet on Thursday, the department acknowledged that it would miss the deadline, suggesting that they would be released by mid-April. It says the delay is due to continuing coordination with a number of foreign governments and ongoing interagency review. One of the governments in question is likely to be Saudi Arabia. Out of 19 terrorists involved in the attacks, 15 were Saudi nationals. The close ties between Al-Qaeda leader Osama bin Laden and the Saudi royal family also raised questions that Saudi Arabian authorities supported the operation. Some observers believe the conflict in Ukraine and the West's sweeping sanctions on Russia, especially its energy sector, which has sent fuel prices skyrocketing around the world, could explain the delay in the release of the documents, as the United States needs Saudi Arabia, with the world's second largest oil reserves, to fill in the gap.
And obviously there's a quid pro quo going on here. How serious it's going to be is another question. You still got hanging over all of this the fact that Vice President Cheney at the time, in 9/11, arranged for all these Saudis to leave the country, leave the United States and go back to Saudi Arabia. So there was no follow-up at the time, contemporaneously, with the Saudi presence in the United States, or the fact that most of the people who were involved in the actual hijackings of these planes were Saudis. So clearly, there is something here that is extremely troubling. And clearly, the Saudis do not want this out. And I suspect there are large sections of the United States government who are not interested in having a serious discussion about this.
But the delay isn't good news to thousands of families who are seeking justice for the loved ones they lost on 9/11. Soon after taking office, Joe Biden said the U.S. was ending all its support for Saudi Arabia's war on Yemen, proclaiming that the war has to end. But, back in September, the U.S. State Department approved its first major arms sale to the kingdom under President Biden, with the sale of 280 air-to-air missiles valued at up to $650 million. President Biden has broken another promise about defending humanitarian rights, an issue he staked much of his presidency on. Back in February, a declassified U.S. intelligence report concluded that Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman authorized a team of Saudi security and intelligence officials to kill dissident journalist Jamal Khashoggi in 2018. But Biden later decided not to punish bin Salman, saying it would be diplomatically unprecedented for the United States.
It's unlikely that people are going to support the United States in the hour of need without some concessions. I mean, I just don't see it. It's possible, I suppose. Maybe there's some threats or whatever, but it's unlikely. And the Saudis have been very clear in the paper today. They said they want more support by the United States for their adventure in Yemen, among other things. There was a list.
The U.S. takes in stride the violations perpetrated by its allies, while accusing countries it deems its adversaries of the same charges. But will it forgive possible perpetrators of attacks on its own citizens too? What message would that have for the attackers? Wouldn't that embolden them to commit even worse crimes, knowing that they can get away with murder in its most literal sense?
As the war between Russia and Ukraine drags on, there are indications that Ukraine has hosted U.S.-funded labs to develop biological weapons. U.S. Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs Victoria Nuland has admitted that Ukraine hosts biological research facilities.
Ukraine has biological research facilities, which, in fact, we are now quite concerned Russian troops, Russian forces may be seeking to gain control of. So we are working with the Ukrainians on how they can prevent any of those research materials from falling into the hands of Russian forces.
So that Victoria Nuland, the guru of the Maidan, who was passing out cookies to the fascist Azov battalion in 2014 during the coup against the legitimate government, was forced to admit that these facilities were there. She didn't clarify what they were exactly, but she indicated that they were dismantled quickly in order to prevent them from falling into the hands of the Russians.
The admission came after Russia published documents showing that Kiev was ordered to urgently eliminate traces of what was deemed as a biological weapons program financed by the Pentagon. The dangerous pathogens across Ukrainian biolab facilities included anthrax, the plague, tularemia, cholera, and other deadly diseases. In the past several days, long-standing fears, which we have expressed repeatedly for years, regarding the development of military biological materials by the United States on the territory of Ukraine under the auspices of the relevant U.S. Special Services have been confirmed. Earlier, the Russian Defense Ministry said it had found evidence of U.S.-funded biolabs in Ukraine, which had urgently destroyed samples of deadly pathogens when the military offensive started.
I think the United States was caught by surprise now. At first, they've been denying all the accusations that are being made, you know, over the past few months that they're conducting biological warfare research, that you had this incident here, which initially they really couldn't deny.
Russia says U.S. statements about Ukraine's biolabs indicate fears by Washington that the pathogens stored there may fall into the hands of Russian experts. Moscow says they confirmed the U.S.'s violation of the Biological and Toxin Weapons Convention.
So either through surrogate or directly, the United States seems to have been involved in creating a capability that would give a country, an allied country, or the United States, a possibility to conduct biological warfare. And that, of course, is forbidden by a variety of UN conventions.
Russia says it had been closely monitoring the bioweapons programs that were developed by the Pentagon in post-Soviet countries. Russia has accused the U.S. of working in Ukraine since 2005 and being involved in the construction, modernization, and operation of over a dozen biolabs suitable for storing or working with pathogens, including those used in bioweapons.
The fact that they existed in Ukraine, where there was a almost obsessive concern and hatred, I must say, among some of the leading factions, right-wing factions in the Ukrainian government against Russia, that they, I think, would be quite prepared to use them in a war with someone they consider their deadly foe. And if they did so, it was with the full backing of the United States, who set up these facilities in the first place.
Moscow has expressed deep concerns about these facilities in recent years. Moscow says facilities in Ukraine were developing components for biological weapons, noting that in the near future, the ministry would release its analysis of the received documents. Russia also accuses the US of sponsoring biological labs across a number of former Soviet republics, including Kazakhstan, Armenia, Tajikistan, and Georgia.
The Aerospace Force of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps successfully put a reconnaissance satellite into orbit. The Noor-2 was launched from Imam Khomeini Spaceport in Semnan Province. The satellite reached a low orbit of 500 kilometers above the Earth on an Iranian three-stage Qassid carrier, which used a combination of liquid and solid fuels. The Noor-2 became Iran's second military satellite successfully placed in low Earth orbit. Commander of the Space Command of the IRGC's Aerospace Force said Iran's national space and defense organizations, knowledge-based companies, and universities cooperated in the Noor-2 project. Brigadier General Ali Jafarabadi explained that the domestically manufactured satellite incorporates the newest technology. It is the upgraded version of Noor-1, which was launched into orbit 21 months ago. Data obtained by Iran's second military satellite can have multiple general and defensive uses. The Noor-2 will orbit the Earth every 90 minutes and will pass over the Iranian sky 16 times every day. Its mission will last at least 3 years. The commander explained that the IRGC will launch a series of Noor satellites in the coming years to consolidate its position in low Earth orbit before aiming for the orbit 36,000 kilometers above land. The latest achievements of Iran's space program came a few days after the IRGC unveiled two underground bases housing state-of-the-art missiles and attack drones. Iran has been relentlessly developing new weapons and military equipment, arguing that it needs the means to defend itself in the world's most volatile region. Just weeks ago, the country unveiled a state-of-the-art ballistic missile with pinpoint precision. Khaybar Shekan boasts high maneuverability when it dives down, making it a nightmare for the world's most advanced missile shields. Iranians have stressed that their defense program grew out of the war initiated by Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein in the 1980s. Saddam's forces showered Iranian cities with missiles and bombs provided by the East and the West, while Iranians say no one sold them any proper means of defense. Iranians argue that they have no choice but to build their own defense industry. The latest achievements strongly suggest that Iran's pursuit of robust defense capabilities is in full swing despite stringent American sanctions.
I think that these developments send several interrelated messages, the first and foremost being that Iran's technological development will not be held back by the obviously failed efforts of the United States and its allies to curtail Iranian technological development. It sends another similar message regarding sanctions, that sanctions are going to be completely ineffectual in terms of holding back Iran's scientific as well as industrial development.
Iran is still engaged in the negotiations in the Austrian capital aimed at removing the sanctions, but its defense industries are not waiting for the talks to end in an agreement. Observers believe Iran's launch of a military satellite into orbit as talks in Vienna are still underway is sending a clear message that it will never negotiate over its defense capabilities and that no agreement can ever restrict its defense, missile, and space programs. The Islamic Republic has made it clear that it will never ask for permission from anyone to manufacture its own means of defense.
The world is closely watching the Russia-Ukraine conflict as it can potentially end in outcomes that would send shockwaves across the globe. Russia launched what it calls a special military operation to demilitarize and denazify Ukraine. That came despite weeks of warnings from Western capitals that such a move would bring catastrophic results. The United States and its allies decided not to confront Russia directly and resorted to supporting Ukraine with intelligence and military hardware. They launch another war that isn't fought with bullets or rockets, but affects banks and financial institutions, an economic war. Washington and its allies have announced several rounds of sanctions on Russia, mostly targeting its banks and energy sector. The scrapping of the highly anticipated Nord Stream 2 pipeline project that would transfer Russian gas directly to Germany was among the measures. Moscow has already warned that it could cut its gas supplies to Germany via the Nord Stream 1 pipeline.
The implications of this event on the economy, the implications of this for the Russian economy, I don't think are quite as tragic as some of the Western press would like to have us believe, because I believe that the Russians have a great many more shock absorbers because they are less exposed than many of the Western capitalist economies.
The tensions risk escalating into a wider energy crisis in Europe, which has over the past year experienced shortages of fuel and price hikes. The military conflict and ensuing sanctions are already showing their effects, but not only on Russia. Deputy Prime Minister Alexander Novak said crude prices could surge to over $300 per barrel if the U.S. and European Union ban imports of oil from Russia. Oil prices have already spiked to close to $140 per barrel, the highest since the 2008 financial crisis. Western sanctions on Moscow, coupled with logistics turmoil, have also shaken markets for other commodities. U.S. wheat futures rose more than 7%, nearing an all-time high amid fears of supply chaos. European wheat has already hit record highs as deepening Western sanctions against Russia fueled concerns about exports from the Black Sea region. Russia is the world's biggest wheat exporter. Russia and Ukraine account for about 29% of global wheat exports. In stock markets, European shares fell to their lowest in a year, with Germany and Italy's benchmark index slipping into a so-called bear market.
The economic impacts of this crisis, of this war, is not something that we're going to be able to that the world will not be able to undo, even if there is a peace treaty in the short term, because the disruptions and the lack of confidence in the old geopolitical arrangements is a permanent damage that will profoundly affect the world economy.
What should be taken into account is that you can't simply remove a cog from the system and expect it to continue working without a hitch. Sanctions might hurt Russia for the short term, but in the long run, everyone will lose.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and his immaculate progeny. Dear brothers and sisters all around the world, assalamu alaikum and welcome to yet another edition from a series of Q&A in Islamic beliefs from IRIB English Radio. Dear brothers and sisters, if you have been following this series of shows, we are trying to answer the doubts and misconceptions on the Islamic beliefs, which are received usually in the form of questions from different questioners from around the world. The question of the day that has been asked is, again, concerning the personality and characteristics of an imam as a role model and the leader of the Islamic Ummah. It has been asked that how should we call an imam, or how should we look at an imam as a role model while he lived, let's say, 14th century ago or 13th century ago? And how can he be a role model for us today? This question actually stems from the different doubts and misconceptions that says that, for example, the lifestyles have changed and facilities that people had at that time were limited. And let's say the knowledge of people at that time was quite limited. And even the time of the Prophet, for example, the society was not that mature. And now with the modern technologies, we have everything. So no need to look at them as a role model. And what does it mean that to stay living, for example, in 14th century ago, based on the circumstances that the Prophet of Islam or even the Imams have been living? Does it look rational and, let's say, rational and wise to follow whatever they have been saying for the people of that time? So definitely the needs and requirements of people also changed. This is the question that we want to ask it from the respected guest, the speaker of the show, Sheikh Nur Muhammad, and ask him to shed some light on that. Sheikh, the question was quite clear, and the concern of the brother or sister who has asked this question is quite clear. So are we really in need of such role models from past, and can't we find the same role models in our today's era, and we are obliged to follow the same role models that is starting from the Holy Prophet of Islam and actually continuing in the lineage of the Prophet through the Imams of Ahlul Bayt?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. You see, they're talking about the Islamic lifestyle, or, for example, Noble Prophet or Ahlul Bayt. They're considered to be role models for our youth and for, of course, all peoples. You see that when we look at the for example, talking about Islamic lifestyle, you see that this lifestyle is completely, we can practice it nowadays. Mm-hmm. I want to say that if you go to the, for example, you see that we have a lot of shows and episodes about the Islamic lifestyles.
True.
Islamic lifestyle. And, of course, we have a lot of definition and explanation in the verse of Noble Quran and in the narrations of Ahlul Bayt, expanding on Islamic lifestyle. You see that we can have this Islamic lifestyle, and I believe that it is a best version of lifestyle nowadays, even in this modern era that we are living in this contemporary era. Mm-hmm. We can have this lifestyle, and we can choose it, and we can practice it. And sure, it is one of the best, of course.
Yeah.
You see that about the, for example, Noble Prophet Muhammad or his pure progeny, they are our role models. Mm-hmm. They are our role models because we have in the verses of Noble Quran or in the narration talking about this personality to be perfected human being, and Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala introduced them to be our role models.
Yeah.
I want to say that we have history gap between us and between them. Mm-hmm. Of course, it is no doubt about that. But how they are considered to be our role models? For example, if you go to the Sunan al-Nabi and the tradition of the Noble Prophet, and of course about his lifestyle, or for example, about the lifestyle of Ahlul Bayt, alayhi salatu wasalam, we can practice their lifestyle, and of course we can have them to be our role models.
Yeah.
You see that, for example, Noble Prophet was against oppression. Mm-hmm. And he was, if you go to the tradition of Noble Prophet and about his Sunnah, we have some books which has been compiled about the Sunan al-Nabi, or about the tradition of Noble Prophet and his customs. You see that he was, for example, giving some charity to the orphans.
Yeah.
And his practice, he was always against the oppression and injustice. Of course, I want to say that we have a lot of codes in this year, in this era, talking about Islamic lifestyle and the lifestyle of Noble Prophet. We can practice the same. Even in this time, we can be, of course, we have to be against injustice.
Mm-hmm.
We should give charity to the poor people and to the destitute. And so on and so forth.
So what you mean is that we just need to take the basics and basis from them. So and if we have got to know and got familiar and acquainted with the basis of their thinking system, so that would be enough for us. When we are looking after the when we are following the Holy Prophet, it means that we are following the culture that he brought up to the humanity, or the Imams of Ahlul Bayt, because then we have become familiar with the basis of their thinking system.
Exactly. I want to say that we have some differences, or forms are maybe different. Mm-hmm. For example, Imam Sajjad alayhi salatu wasalam, he was giving charity in that specific way. He was carrying a baggage, for example, and he was carrying to the poor people.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe in this time that we are living, you do not need to carry a baggage.
Very true.
I want to say that in this way. But the concept of giving charity be helpful for the destitute and poor people.
It doesn't matter that you're living in a village or, let's say, a small city or a large city.
Exactly.
So the change of paradigm only here is that the only paradigm that is changing is that the environment changes.
Exactly. I want to say that we have some changes in the forms,
mm-hmm.
okay, which we call it mutaghayyirha, or some changes in the form of practicing something. On the other hand, we have something which is unchangeable,
mm-hmm.
okay, which always remain forever.
Al-muhkamat.
Or you can call it thawabit, or something unchangeable, or mm-hmm. a strong thing which remain forever, everlasting mm-hmm. concept. And these concepts are, prevailing all over the time in each place and in each time. You can have it and you can practice it.
Very true.
Okay? I want to say that Islamic contents are, talking about this basis, this prevailing and this everlasting content.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Yeah.
And this content you can have and you can practice it all over the time. In different places, it doesn't matter whether you are European, American, whether you are living in this time or, for example, 100 years after this time. It doesn't matter. And it's not only, about the Ahlul Bayt to be our role model. We have the same story about the verses of Noble Quran.
Yeah.
For example, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala said that, وَلَا تَقْتُلُ النَّفْسَ الَّتِي هَرَّمَ اللَّهُ إِلَّا بِالْحَقِّ. Do not kill and do not murder anybody.
Very
okay.
True.
Sometimes it was, for example, by the form of knife, and for example, killing by this means. But nowadays you cannot, for example, shoot a person and kill him by gun. So,
questions and answers on Islamic beliefs on IRIB English Radio. You can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
Shekhna, you refer to killing and taking the life of a person, and it's true that, for example, the basics and basis of Islam tells us that we are not allowed and prohibited from killing a person. It's as if you have killed the whole world, and this is a very beautiful concept that we can find it in the religion of peace that is Islam. But a kind of, let's say, doubt and misconception, which is related to this same concept, is that, okay, if a person killed, let's say, a lady for retaliating her a person needs to pay half of a blood money to do the retaliation. So if it was for the ladies at the dawn of the slum, because the ladies at that time were not that educated. For example, now we have some ladies who are educated and they are engineers, they are doctors. So a lady might be working even more efficiently than a man in today's life. So they are, I think they are somehow actually stuck in such sort of misconceptions.
Of course, talking about the blood money of the ladies, because this is not a topic of our discussion, but very briefly,
Very briefly. No, I wanted to refer to the kind of, let's say, series of problems that led the questioner to ask such a question. He might say that, okay, these issues were for the time of the Prophet, so we need to update ourselves. Okay, we can update. The answer is that we can update ourselves based on the same basis that the Prophet introduced to the world. So I'm listening to your explanation.
Exactly. Chef. I just want to very briefly mention this point that we cannot look at Islamic laws alone. Mm-hmm. For example, you say talking about the blood money, or I can give you more example about the heritage. Mm-hmm. Why the heritage of the woman is half of the man, okay? Mm-hmm. And so on and so forth about Islamic financial issues. The answer is that we should
look wholeheartedly.
We should look at all Islamic laws in the, you know, comprehensive way. I mean, in an inclusive way, actually. Mm-hmm. By this, you know, this inclusive look at Islamic laws, because Islamic laws are systematic. By systematic, I want to say that it has its kind of nidam, which mm-hmm. we call it some system mm-hmm. for Islamic laws. Okay, these Islamic laws in this system has its own role to play.
Yeah.
Okay. I want to say that if you look at other Islamic laws regarding the family financial issues and family financial responsibility, you see the financial responsibility is for the most, you know, in Islam is upon the man.
Yeah.
And man has the responsibility to support his family. Mm-hmm. And because of that, you know, this financial, aid and support should go to the man, not to the woman.
Yeah.
Of course, if you have this role, الرِّجَالُ قَوَّامُونَ عَلَى النِّسَاءِ, okay?
Yeah.
In the verse of Noble Quran, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala said that men are manager of the family, and they have the responsibility to support financially their family.
Many thanks, dear Sheikh, for your explanation. So, all in all, what we have understood from your explanations, the whole system should be looked at. I mean, the whole thing as a system. So we cannot look at, for example, one part of it and criticize the other part. When all of these rules and regulations are going to be looked with one eye, then it is seen that, okay, that system works properly.
Like, for example, the example of puzzles. Mm-hmm. You know, each puzzle has its own place.
Yeah.
If you put it in its own place, okay, its proper place, it has its own, mm-hmm. you know, post, and it can, you know, has its own role to play.
Yeah. And those who are criticizing, we need to ask them, so what is the substitute? Bring us a good substitute for that, if you know any. Then we see that the substitutes are usually the ones that are full of mistakes and full of, let's say, deficiencies that they are even do not worth talking and, let's say, working on them as well. Many thanks, dear Sheikh, for your explanations and scholarly enlightenment. And you, respect listeners, for listening and staying tuned with Q&A in Islamic Beliefs from IRB English Radio.
إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي حسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن كل من كان محبا لهم كل من كان محبا لهم يدخل أنت من غير حزن يدخل الجنة من غير حزن إن في الجنة نارا من لبن إن في
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
With the presence of different scholars. IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is your host Musa Al-Bahadili and you are now listening to the program Viewpoints. Joining us in the studio today is our dear friends, Sheikh Muhammad Khani from the Islamic Seminary of Qum and Dr. Ali Alawiyan. Dear brothers, I welcome you warmly and thank you for joining us.
JazakAllah khair. Thank you so much.
Our topic today is I want to say it's a controversial one. Inshallah, we will come to a shared understanding of how we should answer this question or how we should treat this subject generally. Mm-hmm. And this topic is about religious education. Are you then forcing religion on people who do not want to be that religious or who are not interested in the religion?
Yeah, well, we're responsible for raising our children, right? So actually it would be the exact opposite. You would be neglecting your responsibility as parents if you don't raise them according to what you believe, which is the truth, right?
Right.
If I believe that this is goodness, and this is good for my children, I'm responsible to teach them these values.
That's natural, but what about parents who are not that religious?
Parents that are not that religious?
Yeah, we have a lot of them. They do not care that much about Islam. They have some Islamic teachings, they follow them. They do not want their kids to be that involved with Islam. How should we treat this issue?
So let's clarify the circumstances first. Are you talking about an Islamic country or a non-Islamic country?
Yeah.
Islamic country, for example.
Islamic country. A person who lives in an Islamic country and majority of the people who are in that society are Muslims or not Muslims?
Naturally, a Muslim.
So then we're looking on the, let's say, priority of those whose kids are going to be in these schools. So yeah.
The majority.
The majority of those who are living here, and if they
but
are
let's
going...
take that logic, dear doctor, and then apply it in a secular society as in Europe. What would the answer then be?
Then we cannot decide the curriculum as Muslims in a good country where, of course, they they don't believe in Islam. So we need to start somewhere else. But when it comes to our own schools, then I have a responsibility towards these children, whether their parents like it or not. So I'm going to tell the parents of these children, look, we have these different fields of knowledge, and we're going to study these different classes and these books. If you don't like it, you have your own free will to find another school. But when your child is in our school, I don't care what you teach them at home. This is what they're being taught here in our school. Right?
Sheikh, let me answer the brother, because he was talking about an Islamic country. And Iran can be one of those targets of the question that the brother raised, right? Look, when I'm talking about the majority, I mean to be included in the curriculum. But then again, there is no force and enforcement to have the students to follow for those who are not interested. There are some schools that they are not offering, for example, religious studies still, even in Tehran now.
Right.
And they actually, instead, they have some ethics books, and they actually have replaced them with these ethics, and it is
good. Which ethics books, if I might ask?
There are some something about general ethics, what is good and what is bad. Though it is, again, rooted in Islam, in religions, but they want satisfy themselves that, we're not going to study, and we are not interested in the Islamic studies. And moreover, for those who are not interested, the subject of Islamic studies is not something which is mandatory in their reports, right?
Right.
So again, they have this freedom to have that. But bring it back to your first question, then invest. Are they really behaving people like that and treating people like that, like in a country like France? So they are forcing you not to study religion.
Even Denmark, where we are from, like we know it, like we've seen
it,
we experienced it.
I want to reach to this comparison. Yeah,
there's parts of the curriculum which is values that they believe is the truth, and they present it as the absolute truth: freedom of speech, democracy.
In reality,
Of course, there's liberal freedom, like ideas of liberalism, which is being promoted as the absolute truth in our schools. And if you don't accept it, it's as if, like, okay, then you accept a dictatorship, for example.
You're an enemy of the state.
You're an enemy of the state, basically, if you don't accept democracy. So I think that every society works on actually promoting the values that they found truthful. So I don't think that Muslims should be different, right? We actually have proof why our values are the truth, right? So in contrary to, like these ideas, these liberal ideas, which can't be proven, which are contradicts with each other. So I think it's very important for us, like, not to be so scared or sensitive because of the secular movements that exist out there, and to be like, look, this is our religion. Of course, we're going to teach it to our children, right? So when I said philosophical thinking, just not to be misunderstood, basically, what I said is not philosophical thinking, what we understand from the Islamic seminary. Like, you teach philosophy, mawjood bima huwa mawjood, and then you discuss philosophy. That's not what I mentioned. No, the fact that they can actually think for themselves. For example, if you want to discuss philosophical thinking for children, how do you do that? Contemplate. We have it in the narrations. Contemplate over the different blessings that Allah has given you. So if a teacher can make a child contemplate over what he's been blessed with, for example, I've been blessed with good parents, God, he gives me this, he gives me that, that's a philosophical thinking, because he's contemplating this young person. And that's normally something which we are a lot of the times, unfortunately, we are being deprived of in other countries. Why? Because children, they are being forced into, for example, accepting games, following their desires, their worldly desires, which normally prevents them from actually having this ability to think philosophically, to contemplate and think.
So dear Sheikh, you would say that in Western societies or where the Islamic community is present, we should teach them about Islamic rulings, Islamic teachings generally.
As the doctor he mentioned, it's important to emphasize on that Islamic lifestyle.
Lifestyle.
Because that encompasses like all the different aspects and not only one certain aspect. Because just teaching rulings to a person that don't understand why he should follow those rulings, he's not going to
have no conviction to follow.
Exactly, right? He's not going to feel He's not going to feel responsible when it comes to these rulings, right? He's not going to feel obligated. So you have to understand Islam as a package. That's why Imam Tabatabai, rahmatullahi alayhi, when he defines Islam, he says it's a lifestyle. It's a lifestyle that leads you to the absolute perfection towards Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Everything that can help to with that goal or for you to reach that goal, that will be considered as a part of Islam. Let's say, for example, working out, going to the gym. If you do it with the sake of, for example, reaching Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala by being healthy and therefore doing your responsible, your religious duties, that becomes an ibadah for yourself, right? That's become a part of Islam, actually.
Then let me pose this question. We agree that religion should be taught, at least Islamic religion, Islamic teachings. What about religion in general? Should we also provide a curriculum where we talk about religion in general, Christianity, Judaism?
For the followers of different religions, it is a must.
Right.
Yeah.
And even in our country, we have provided, for example, the scholars of Ahl Sunnah have provided the books for the Sunni students here in this country, Christians, Jews, and they have written the books, and they are the official books of the Ministry of Education of country.
But doesn't that lead to problems between the different religions in the country? If perhaps
no, they need to follow. Because we're not after changing the people's religion. We want them to be actually to be adhering to their own beliefs. So we want this this freedom of studying their own religions. Mm. So this is what is being practiced here, and we want the same to happen in the West.
So
they talk about liberty and liberal,
but then they only teach liberalism. We're forced to like not accepting Islam or stand by Islamic values. And
it's nice, Sheikh. I had a guest from one of the Southeast Asian countries. He came to meet us here in Qom. And when I took him to the bookshops and
bookstores,
he was astonished that when he saw that Sahih Bukhari is available in our bookstores. He said, oh, it's possible. How come we cannot find even a single book of Shia in our country? But here,
You can find Minhaj al-Sunnah.
Minhaj al-Sunnah. Me here, you can't find it.
You can find the life biography of Michelle Obama. I saw
Michelle Obama. I saw that as well.
What?
So a Christian, a Jewish scholar is writing the book in based on their own beliefs for their students. So this is the meaning of the verse that is going to be interpreted.
But doctor, the problem is what then if we have an author or a sect or a religion who is directly adverse to our beliefs and teachings.
Mm-hmm.
And they also have books and they also sell these books and they also present here also in Qom.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And people read these books. Isn't that a huge problem? Doesn't that lead to corruption? Because you have I know teenagers, Muslims, who like they read these books. And then they developed this relation and these beliefs that intermingle with Islam and directly clash with Islam.
Mm-hmm.
So shouldn't we also censor some of these books?
Yeah, this is a good discussion about censorship, whether we should be like completely liberal when it comes to these ideas. So I think we should distinguish between political movements, like people that are using these ideas and theories to ruin the social cohesion in a society. That's one part. That's one discussion for itself. But people know they're only explaining. That's the only thing that they do. I think that you need to have discussions and you need to, what is it called, reply to some of the arguments they come with, right?
Right.
Argue why your belief is the right and why they're wrong. Because just censoring people doesn't make their ideas disappear, right? So the ideas are going to stay. So you need to explain why their ideas are wrong. If you believe that they're false and they're harmful for a person or for a society,
so
you need to explain it. You don't have to censor it. But when it starts a political movement and they're starting to ruin the social coexistence or the cohesion in a country or in a society, definitely, I think that that's the responsibility of the state to take action here.
Sheikh, I am wrong, but for just...
I want to go one step back behind where the Sheikh said. Look, when we are talking about Islamic religion, not every religion's book is going to be allowed in the society. For example, in public, even for the use of the kids. Look, Abrahamic religions I'm talking about, they are allowed to have.
Abrahamic religions? Because already you've censored some religions.
The religions which are being accepted worldwide by all the people, so not man-made religions.
What about Hinduism?
Look, we are talking even Abrahamic religion in every part of the world. They have good coexistence with each other, and they had it from before, and they had no problem. Even the books and the sources.
I agree, and I accept that. So you should say the Abrahamic religions, they should be united, but Hinduism, Buddhism, and Shintoism, we should leave that out.
Definitely.
Yeah, so I think there's a difference between accepting them having their books or letting the knowledge being available and actively promoting these ideas or teaching children these ideas. I think there's a difference between the two. Of course, I would never go home and teach my child ideas that I know would confuse the person.
Like, but imagine, dear Sheikh, you go home and you find your child, your son, who's grown up, reading a book about Hinduist teachings because he found it at a shop at a discount.
That's completely fine. I wouldn't prevent him from doing so. I would explain why it's wrong.
Ah, but you would explain why it is wrong.
Yeah, definitely.
Right. And here's the problem. We do not have that explainer of why it is wrong. We only have these books freely available and people buy them and read them and eat them up.
Yeah. So, yeah. And that's the thing that so that goes back. That's a criticism which I believe that is needs to be pointed towards, like students of the Islamic seminary. That's very important. People that study Islamic studies, they should work within these fields and make sure that the knowledge is available. Or at least give an answer from an Islamic perspective or viewpoint on these subjects. But I don't think censorship is the way to deal with these things. On one hand, second, if it's a political movement, that's a discussion for itself. If they're causing harm to the security in a country where they're developing ideas as a group and so on and so forth, then that's different.
Closing comment, Dr.
What I mentioned actually about the Abrahamic religion and their liberty and having their own books for their own kids' education, it was in the level of countrywide, not in specific or limited level. Moreover, as for those other followers of religions, you said other religions that you have been talking about and mentioned. So, to the extent that the person has a good, let's say, power to criticize and to read critically the book, it's okay. And if he has no power and to no enlightenment or no power to distinguish between what is good or bad based on the verdicts of the scholars, so it is forbidden to read those books.
But we are helping by providing these books. We're not distinguishing who can buy them.
I told you, at least in this country, we're not actually providing them the books because... this censorship is not, again, in the sense that you are talking about. Look, for example, the schools, Indian schools in Tehran, they have these books of Buddhism.
In their communities, of course.
Their own communities. Yeah, they are all okay to follow their own religions.
I would love to continue this discussion, but we are unfortunately out of time. I thank the dear Dr. Ali Aulian for joining us and for providing us with insightful knowledge. And also thank the dear Sheikh Mohammed Khani for joining us and contributing to this fruitful discussion.
Thank you so much.
Finally, I thank the dear listeners for tuning in. Until next time, fi amanillah.
The same when I'm too concerned by what they say. Why should I wanna have you to doubt you would be the worst mistake? Deep inside I know that amidst all the darkness and everything which makes no sense, I know that you exist. Guides me through my darkest nights, shows me right from wrong in a world that often lies. Cause I don't need anyone, anything in life but you. No, I don't need anyone to show me my way. No, I don't need anyone but you.
in the limelight.
The Zionist regime is doubling down on its apartheid rule over Palestinians while it and its international accomplices attempt to fend off the label. Please stay with us for an article in this regard written by Maureen Claire Murphy, journalist. This article is titled, Zionist Regime Doubles Down on Apartheid. Here's more on this issue. The Zionist regime is doubling down on its apartheid rule over Palestinians, while it and its international accomplices attempt to fend off the label. Recently, the Zionist regime reinstated a ban on Palestinian family unification as part of its demographic engineering efforts to ensure a Jewish majority in the territory of historic Palestine. Adala, a group that advocates for the rights of Palestinians in the occupied territories, said that the legislation is one of the most racist and discriminatory laws in the world and must immediately be repealed. The Citizenship and Entry into Israel order prohibits the Zionist regime's interior minister from granting residency or citizenship to Palestinians from the West Bank and Gaza who marry citizens of the occupied territories. According to Adala, which will challenge the law at the Zionist regime's high court, it also bans unification between a citizen or resident of Palestinian territories with spouses from Syria, Lebanon, Iraq. Adala added that UN human rights bodies have called on the Zionist regime to revoke the ban on Palestinian family unification as it violates the international law. The Zionist regime's parliament, the Knesset, has renewed the temporary order banning family unification 21 times over the past 18 years, the rights group added. However, unlike in the past, the current version of the law explicitly states that its purpose is to ensure a Jewish demographic majority, Adala added. The Zionist regime lawmakers and Ayelet Shaked, the regime's interior minister, has said the legislation is intended to prevent Palestinians from gradually returning to their homeland. Demographic engineering is also informing the Zionist regime's policy on refugees fleeing the violence. Recently, Shaked said that the influx of mostly non-Jewish Ukrainians fleeing to the occupied territories cannot go on. Shaked added, anyone with a brain understand that we can't continue at this rate of entry. The Zionist regime's obsession with demographics is nothing new. It has prevented millions of Palestinian refugees and their descendants from exercising the right to return to lands from which they were forcibly displaced on the basis that they are not Jewish. Shaked acknowledged the apartheid nature of the family unification law by tweeting that its approval was a victory for a Jewish and demographic regime and a loss for a regime of all its citizens. The Zionist regime's law, passed in 2018, stipulates that the right to exercise self-determination in Israel is unique to the Jewish people. Stateless Palestinians living in the West Bank and Gaza face similar restrictions, with the Zionist regime refusing to confer residency status to foreign nationals who are married to Palestinians living in those territories. Jewish settlers face no such restrictions. Amnesty International highlights the Zionist regime's denial of nationality, residence, and family life in its recent report, finding that the Zionist regime practices apartheid against Palestinians. The suspension of family unification procedures in the West Bank and Gaza affects tens of thousands of foreign nationals married to Palestinians. Meanwhile, the Zionist regime prohibits Palestinians in Gaza from residing.